A couple of correction for sure, in an addition to yesterday's conversation, because I'm glad y'all keep me honest, which is a good thing. And so the doctor kindly, where is Dr. Doug back there? Yay. It's not, he disputes, and he checked with a colleague that fear increases calcium levels. So we're going to be careful about that. It's cortisol, though, that was not mentioned in the Wikipedia article that I'd heard about that's really increased when we encounter fear. And that leads to increased blood pressure and increased blood glucose, so it's coursing through your veins, so you have plenty of energy. But long-term cortisol effect can lead to the leaching of calcium from bones, but it's not an immediate response. But then we were talking further yesterday. So if we're in a state of sort of general anxiety in our society right now, and maybe it's not, you know, the immediate fear response, but we could have this cortisol stuff going on, it could lead to diabetes. Isn't that what we decided, doctor? Yeah. So we wonder sometimes, or I've wondered in the past, about the higher incidence of diabetes amongst African Americans. And some people want to point to their diet, but if you think you wake up every day knowing that you have the possibility that your right to be someplace is going to be challenged, my guess is that there's a cortisol. Now, I made that up. I don't know. There's probably studies done, and you could check up on that. But then just a way for us to see that even though this is another rabbit hole down which I am going, clear to me, after the Ferguson incident, when Michael Brown was killed, and then we were waiting for the grand jury decision, and we were a bunch of us, all of us at the Churchwide Center were this, and I just remember that we're all walking in the same time, and we're all breathing the same air, but it became very clear to me that the experiences of that my colleagues on staff were people of color were very different. And then when the verdict came that there was to be no indictment of the officer, we did a die-in, and I didn't get the memo. So, and that's where you lie down on the ground for a while. Yeah. I hadn't done any sort of protest since college, so this is my first time in a while. And so we're going to do this, and then our building manager said, I don't know if any of you have been to the Churchwide offices in Chicago. It's a lovely complex of buildings. Well, the buildings aren't so lovely. They're pretty, you know, corporate. But we have a lovely oval in the front with plantings and grass and whatever, and we were going to lie down on the grass. And then our building manager said, you can't do that because there are other buildings, other offices, and they might be enticed to come out there and they could get fired from their jobs. And we're like, I don't think that's really going to happen. And then she said, what we need to do, we could have it in an alternate space. We said, oh, that's okay, good. What it would be? She goes, on the abandoned seventh floor. I was like, no, the point is to be seen. This is the point, is to be seen. And she was looking out for our interests and others. And we had got our general counsel involved. He said, no, it's fine. So we did. And then, you know, if you see I think we saved the picture. I am the only one in a raincoat, skirt, heels and heels, lying on the grass. I didn't get the memo, so I don't protest that well. But then we came in and had a chance to have lunch together and then just hear people's stories. And one after another of your colleagues, your staff people, my colleagues of color, told of times a headlight's not on and they get pulled over. One woman was leaving a concert and she was driving in an area that was mostly white. She got pulled over. Another colleague recounted a time when her son, who went to a Lutheran school, they had a day off when the public school's different. He was stopped by the police, beaten, and left in the field. And so this is like, wow, this is just you can see why cortisol would be rising. There's a different experience. We also spent time, I remember, talking to police who also felt under tremendous pressure and still do. So there's an interesting thing. But so that's one thing that fear does. Before I go on to more fear stuff, I've got more fear stuff here for us. Oh, good. I only got through two of my four emphases yesterday. Sorry, because I got like, I don't know, I did. So they are all four. I'll do them all together before I flesh them out. We are church. We're Lutheran. We're church together. We're church for the sake of the world. It's not that earth-shattering. I had felt that we had strayed away from some of that. So when 2013 came around and we were at the churchwide assembly in Pittsburgh, I really just wanted to have a conversation. I just wanted to lay that out there so we could think about it. And as you can see, that conversation got really out of hand because here I am. So, so church, that's who we are first. And we were talking a little bit yesterday, what is our center, which I think in some ways, not to be indicting, but in some ways we've lost the clarity about what our center is as church, which is the cross. And we as Christians and as Lutheran Christians, the way we understand God's work in the world, and not just exclusively for Christians, we think this is a gift to the entire world, but we understand it particularly through God's redeeming and reconciling work in the incarnation, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ. That's really important. And some of you were talking to me yesterday about how difficult it is. I happen to be a Swede, so you Norwegians are off the hook. I don't know how Danes and Finns operate on this thing, too, and Germans and whatever. But she said that it's almost impossible for people to talk about their faith, and that in her community, at least, they're very reticent about anything. It's not just their faith life, but just you're not going to talk about this stuff. Well, last night, what a great example. So Padraig sits down with all these kids and all of us, right? And my guess is we were all having that same walk with Jesus. And we were asking him questions, no, not like that one, how's your day? One little child asked Jesus, how's your day been? That was so beautiful. And maybe we did hear Jesus responding to us. And then maybe we did say a farewell and have that sense. And we could do that in our minds. The children can say it out loud, though there was one who said, I'd rather keep it to myself. It was great. And Padraig said, well done. But if we were able, and then where's the deacon from Washington who works with Chris Berger? She's at another session. Anyway, she does this with her high school youth groups. And they're able to say out loud. So maybe this might be a way for us, in some ways, to be able to say a little bit about how we have encountered Jesus. And we might just start out with, I'd rather keep it to myself for the first couple of months, but I thought it was just so brilliant how he did that. And, you know, I could listen to his Irish accent all day long. Okay, so church, Lutheran, if you have a chance to read anything by Edward Friedman or Family Systems, he makes the controversial statement that empathy is actually dangerous in the sense that if all we can do is feel others and we lose ourself, we're not able to function. And he would make the case that a well-defined, well-regulated self is far more able to engage with somebody else than if we're all just sort of smooshing all over the place. And that's what I mean when I say we're Lutheran. Not that we're somehow better than everybody else, but if we're clear about what that means for us, and not about culture or cuisine, but about our theology and our understanding of the Jesus story, then it's possible for us to have authentic conversations with people of other denominations ecumenically, possible to engage interreligiously without afraid that we're going to lose ourselves and just go to the lowest common denominator and kumbaya and la, la, la. And we wouldn't do that. And then also to have a conversation with those of no faith or in the public square. People might have faith, but in the public square. So that's what I was trying to get across. Now, church together. This one is a tough one. This group knows, it'll make me feel good. How many know you're part of the ELCA if you're Lutheran? Good, yeah. Or the LCMS, how many know you're part of that group? Yeah, see, you know, right. So a lot of folks in our congregations have no idea that there's a church beyond their borders, except for the rival, you know, St. Paul's down the street, you know. They always had the better adult basketball team in the 50s, and we're still having a problem with that, you know. So we don't realize that we're connected to more than just the local congregation. We have, at least in our polity, we have conferences. Do you know the name of your conference? See, this is Lutheran Shangri-La. I am not leaving after the conferences. And conferences belong to synods. Pinelands Conference. That's so nice. And in South Dakota, they have one called Bear Butte. In my synod, we had Cleveland East, Cleveland West, you know. Like, yeah, we didn't have any poetic names. So here's a funny thing, another rabbit hole. So I was talking to the folks in Metro New York, and they're going through some difficulties now with the transition in bishop. And then one fellow stood up, and he's not from the five boroughs. I don't know where part is. And he says, "You don't understand how hard it is. The distances in our synod are just so great that we can't get together." And I'm thinking, you know, in the Rocky Mountain Synod, one conference is Utah. So we are part of this, and then the 65 synods, we work together, and then we're part of the ELCA, those of us who are, and then we're also part of the Lutheran World Federation. So there's a lot more besides the local congregation, and it's, but beyond, you know, put all that, you know, human-made division, categories aside, it's scriptural, it's sacramental. In baptism, we believe that we become part of the body of Christ. And one of my anxieties, I had a horrible anxiety dream last night, but I won't go into that. I think I was worried about my tie-dye shirt not turning out right. And it didn't. It would turn like all this sort of this green with no spots. Anyways, where was I going? Some of my anxiety is that we, a lot of us, particularly I think within in the West now, would see church life as kind of a voluntary association. You could come or you don't have to. You could receive the sacraments or you don't have to. You can contribute or you don't have to. But it's not. Once we're baptized, we are part of the body of Christ. And you just don't, you know, sort of amputate yourself or rip yourself away from that. I don't think that's possible. I mean, you could say, "I'm not going to have anything to do with those folks," but that does not make you, that's a double negative. I'm getting in trouble. You are no longer not a part of the body of Christ. So to understand that. And then also, when I was in the synod and now at the churchwide expression, people would always, you know, when they talk about the synod, you know, they get that look on their face, right? You know, or churchwide. Have you seen that? And it's not just us. I was up in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada and had some of the same questions. What do we get from the churchwide expression? You know, it's like that. What do we get from the synod? And I had a colleague in the synod office, and she said, former Missouri synod, so there you go. And she said, it's not what we get from them. It's what do we get to do as the synod or as church together? And what do we get to do as church, not in the island United States, though we are also in the Caribbean, have one congregation in Canada. What do we get to do together? And we can do so much more together than we can all by ourselves, including theological work, as well as all of the works of diaconal works. So that's just saying that. So it's not American to think of ourselves as a community. It's more American to think of ourselves as the individual. And so who said it the first day he was sitting here? When we're reading Isaiah 43, 1-7, of course God is speaking to us, but God is speaking to the entire community, not just to the individual believer or person. So we're all in this together. That's faster. Then fourth, we're church for the sake of the world. So if we just, you know, just have this wonderful relationship with God and with our members of our congregation and never extend that to the communities in which we are planted, as well as communities across the world, we're really not, I think, living out the call that God places on us to be a blessing to the rest of the world. So I know probably most of your congregations do some kind of hunger ministry, food pantries, community gardens, clothes, closets, that sort of stuff. Yeah, about 90%+ of our congregations do that. So we're engaged in some ways in doing that. But how else can we be engaged with our communities that surround our congregations? And increasingly, I don't know how it is here in the Pacific Northwest, but I would say for the Minnesotans and those of us east of there, increasingly, congregations are founded in neighborhoods that have since transitioned, and they are not white ethnic German Lutheran congregations, neighborhoods anymore. And still we'll have folks coming from the suburbs back to the congregation that was so important, but without engaging the people who are right around them. And we have had an aspiration in this church to be inclusive and multicultural. And when we did a whole conversation across the church, I don't know if it got out to all of you, but we said, what do we believe God is calling this church to be? And overwhelmingly, people said inclusive, multicultural, diverse. Well, as I said, I don't know when, yesterday, the day before, about 5 years ago when we started, that we're the whitest denomination in the United States. So we haven't achieved that. Your secretary, Chris Berger, from Northwest Washington Synod, but he was the bishop there. He proposed a change to the Constitution, which was adopted in 2016, that instead of saying we're going to be 10% people of color, primary language other than English, we were supposed to do that by the first 10 years of the existence of the ELCA. That didn't work. He said that now the Constitution is going to say, instead of putting a number, that the congregation needs to reflect the community in which it is planted, and please give us indications about how the congregation is going to work toward achieving that. And we're not so good at that. And then in the way in which we do that, our understanding of working globally is accompaniment. And some of you who are former YAGAMs or former global mission personnel know that that's, we just don't go out there and convert the heathen. We don't bring God where God already is. That's what Bishop Gonia said when he was on a global mission staff. So we walk alongside with them, knowing that we can learn from those folks as much as we can teach them. And then also God is already active in those places. How do we do that? So similarly in neighborhoods, you know, if we haven't actually talked to people in the neighborhood, how do we know what their hopes and fears are? And how do we would know that they might say, really don't leave us alone. We really don't need you people messing with us. And then do we talk, especially, this is especially effective in small towns. Do we talk with the mayor or city manager, the school board president, the school superintendent? And in small towns, my husband and I found this out, that you can get access to local media pretty easily, especially if you have a pre-written story, or you make friends and get to know the reporters and get the word out about you. And then the tough part is when folks say, okay, I'm going to give this a try, are we really open to folks joining us and changing us? That's the sticky part. Those are the four emphases. I sometimes say about the fourth one that some of the most important words spoken during a liturgy are by the deacon or the assisting minister. Go in peace, serve the Lord, which sends us out to do that sort of thing. And then we need to come back to church. So, okay, there's that. Now we took care of cortisol, we took care of the four emphases, and now we're going to talk about fear again. First, I'll have a sip of coffee to strengthen myself. They have actually good coffee here, don't you think? Yeah, and they don't cook it all day long, but probably because we drink it so fast. Again, I digress, but we had a synod assembly in the Rocky Mountain Synod, and it was in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is really pretty cosmopolitan now and not as strict as some other areas that are predominantly Mormon, but Mormons don't drink coffee. At least they're not supposed to drink coffee. And so they didn't get this, and so the coffee ran out within an hour of the first day, and we were like, what? They said, well, that was a lot of coffee. We said, oh no. So that was, Episcopalians drink a lot of coffee too, I discovered. So you know, you want to know how to keep a Mormon from drinking all your coffee or a Baptist from drinking all your beer? Bring along another Mormon or bring along another Baptist. So. Okay. Were any of you able to go to Glenn Jordan's lecture yesterday? It's marvelous, and thank goodness eventually these will all be available to us. Where did she go? On audio archives. But don't get impatient. Which, you know, what choice do we have here? Anyways, which is true, it's a good thing. So that will be available. So those who could not fit in the room or were not able to be there or doing something else, it's worth listening to and it coming to the rest of the week. He's using the book of Ruth as a way to talk about, they're looking at in Ireland, how to have conversations now, because all the old wounds from since Queen Elizabeth tried to take over the island and colonize it are being reopened because of Brexit. So Northern Ireland is, that's a Protestant state that was artificially carved out according to the people in the Irish Republic in 1921. They are part of the United Kingdom. So Brexit affects them. But then in the Republic of Ireland, they are not. They're not part of that. They're part of the EU. But then having this stark, once again, demarcation about this and being very clear that the northern part of Ireland is loyal to England, Protestant, and all of the... It's been really terrible for them, for the Irish, since Queen Elizabeth, whom I admire, actually, tried to colonize them. And all of those things that they had thought were put to rest... And that after the Good Friday Accords, that they were okay, we can move forward with this. They find all of that is being ripped open, and once again, there's even the possibility of violence. The Orangemen in the north always have the marching season when they sort of celebrate their victories and whatever, and violence can happen there. So they're using, Padraig and Glenn are using the Book of Ruth as a way to get people together to have difficult conversations. And take a look at this. And it's just brilliant how he's doing it. And he, you know, you can listen to Glenn's accent all day, too. He says, well, you know, it's so difficult in the North, particularly in congregations, to have any conversation about Brexit or all of the things that are wrapped up in that. He said, well, our congregations, it's just too difficult to talk about this. And he says, I don't know if you have the same problem here in the United States about certain things. It's like, so we could really, you got it. But he was laying out for us some of the serious divisions between Judah or Israel and Moab. And then he pointed out that when people really start to get to this point of fear, that a lot of mechanisms kind of kick in that would not have been there. And certainly when Yugoslavia fell apart, you know, Christians and Bosnian Muslims lived as neighbors. And when that thing fell apart, they were killing each other. So that happens to us. And interestingly enough, it's the same thing in the, that Friedman points out in a highly anxious society, which is us, is the first thing is that we get to be reactive. And Glenn would say that any Jew listening to the Book of Ruth would only have to hear the word Moab, which, what did he say, was said like three or four times in the first five sentences, to know it's those people. And the Moabites didn't like the Jews either. So you just had to say it, and you reacted to that. And the same thing now. What was a favorite expression in media for a long time? Dog whistle, right? Remember that? We get these fad phrases, and they last for about a month and a half, and then we try to get some else. But dog whistle, there'd be some little thing that someone would say, and you'd react immediately. I would find myself reacting immediately. And so that's one thing, reactivity. You don't take a breath. You don't step back. You don't say, okay, what's going on in me that's getting hooked by this? It's automatic reactivity. And I don't know if you've experienced that at all, either from others or find that happening in you. That's kind of where we are. Another thing is a herding instinct, and Glenn was describing this as loyalty. You have to have absolute loyalty to your group. You couldn't see the other side, because if you saw the other side, you were disloyal. And we tend to clump together, and I made jokes about, and then Padraig was very clear, we're all in our Birkenstocks. I just got these this spring, so I'm kind of proud that I finally, you know, I'm in. My daughter helped me get them. And then I got her maternity Birkenstocks, which are just ones that she wanted, and I'm, you know, she's pregnant, so I bought her what she wanted. So they're blue. So no indication about the gender of the child. We have no idea. There was not a sin. But we come together, and we get into smaller and smaller like-minded groups. There's a book called The Great Sort. I don't know if any of you have read that. You can go on Wikipedia. It might be wrong, but it gives you like a synopsis of this. But it makes the point that at least in U.S. society, we are sorting into smaller and smaller like-minded groups, so that here's another kind of hackneyed phrase, we're in our own little echo chambers where we just hear what we say back and forth over and over and over again. And in the book, they point out there was some community. They were going to start a gated community, and it was for people of a particular political persuasion who supported this one candidate. And I won't say which side it was on, but it was, then you could just be there all the time and you're hurting. And if someone were to say, well, you know, gosh, I think that side might have a point, or maybe we're distorting what they're saying, you're out. And that's what Glenn was talking about, this loyalty, that you cannot be disloyal to your group. And being disloyal is as minimal as saying, I might see that they have a point. So that's another thing that we do when we're in fear all the time. Another thing is blame displacement. They're always wrong, and they've always done it to me, and I am pure as a driven snow, or sand if you're from Arizona. And Glenn had this marvelous example. It was so good that the Israelites would say, you can't trust the Moabites, and you sure don't trust their women. Because those women, they are lascivious and they are loose. And they remember back when Moses was up there, Glenn said, on the mountain again. It's like, okay, what are we going to do? And he comes down and the Moabite women had come in. And as Glenn put it, oh, those dear, sweet sons of Israel, what were they to do when these lascivious women were attacking them? So it wasn't their fault. And it's that way with, you know, with us too. When we get really, it's always somebody else's fault. And there's no hope, I think, or no chance really for getting out of a stuck situation if you believe you're always the victim all of the time. So that's another thing that happens when we live in fear or anxiety. We also come up with a quick fix mentality. And why, I'm good at this. Ask my husband about the various pieces of fitness equipment that we have. He told me when we were living in Ohio, if I got one more piece of fitness equipment, he was going to sell memberships to the basement. So I stopped there. So he's working with a personal trainer now, but not, he goes out to the gym, so that's good. So, you know, anything, it's going to fix this, fix that. And if you think about it now, in our psyche now, we're told, and it's an effective tool, either by the left or the right, but I think it's more prevalent right now, at least in the news, at least in my liberal news, that we have heard from the president that things are in a terrible state of affairs, and he said he is the only one who can fix it. And so if they're the enemy, if you have to be loyal, if you're never wrong, and someone says, I can fix it, that might be a way to alleviate the stress and fear that you feel all the time. So it's very effective, and we sort of get stuck on that. So all of those things are happening when we're, and this is the fear to which God says to the people in Babylon who are captive, fear not. Don't give in to that. My thought, and you heard a preview of the Living Lutheran article for September in part of my sermon last night. So you don't have to read that part of the magazine, or I should have told you in advance, and you wouldn't have to have come to Vespers on Monday night, but oh well. But that kind of fear, I think, really just makes the world smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And it makes our lives more cramped and inhibited, and it's this really debilitating fear that has actual physical consequences when we live that way all the time, but also has huge consequences for us as a people. If I get to the point in my fear and trying to find some relief and protection against the thing I fear, and what's really insidious right now, there are actual things to be afraid of. But we're also hearing statements like, there's something going on out there. And so it becomes in the ether. And if I get in there, then I'm just going to draw into myself or people who think like me or believe like me or look like me because I'm afraid. And that just makes the world a tiny, small, constricting, inhibiting, I think in some ways a suffocating space. And that's the fear about which God says, fear not. Which, you know, if we really live into that and believe that, that's an act of courage and I think also of spiritual and physical protest. That we could engage in if we're not constantly afraid. And I'll tell you, it's, you know, we like to, I'm from the liberal camp, so I'll out myself. We like to take with those conservatives, which is the blaming and putting over there. We do it the same thing. We who are, you might not all be in the liberal camp, we do the same thing. They found that during the last presidential campaign, that when Hillary Clinton would sort of say, you know, this guy could be have his fingers on the nuclear codes, but all people heard was, the world's a scary place, the world's a scary place. So her attempt just hooked into more fear for other people. So that's not, we have to stand against that. So that kind of fear can be really inhibiting. But there is a kind of fear, and I want to make sure, if you have a question or you want to challenge me or whatever, because I kind of talked a long time yesterday. But there is a kind of fear that I think opens us up. And that's the it seems to be the counterintuitive, contradictory description in Scripture, and also the command in Luther's explanation of the commandments, that we are to fear God. That the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And Luther would say we are to fear and love God so that. And I know I was in my first parish, and I was the assistant pastor. I wasn't even the associate. I was the assistant pastor. And, you know, here I am with all my 27 years of wisdom at this time. And this we were an adult, I think it was a Sunday school class, and this one woman was saying, you know, I don't understand this fear, God. That has been, it makes me want to weep. It's frightening. I don't like that. What is that? In fact, I hate that. And so for her whole life, she thought she had to be afraid of God in the sense of the fear that causes us to collapse in ourselves. Or in the sense as if we take one toe out of the line, we're going to get zapped. Or in the sense where some people come to the point, someone was telling me a story about a mother-in-law who'd been a faithful person her whole life. And now at the point of death, she was afraid because what if she was not good enough to get into heaven? That was the kind of fear this woman had felt when she was studying the catechism. And I said, it's not that kind of fear. This kind of fear, for one, opens up our world. If we're no longer the center of our crowded little worlds, the world can be a far bigger place. If we have a sense that there is something greater than ourselves, it's amazing to me the Marines come up with the best slogans. They should write for Augsburg Fortress. There's something greater than ourselves. It's not just on us all of the time. And for the Lutherans amongst us, let's be serious. We still believe in that if we could just give a little extra oomph and self-justification, maybe we'll slip into heaven, right? Be honest, brothers and sisters, okay? Grace is a very difficult concept to believe and trust all of the time. It's true, but we're not always there because what if it isn't enough? So it is. So good. So here is this sense, but also, and this is something that concerns me, not just with young people, as I said before, but with all of us. This is fear in the sense of awe. And fear in the sense of something being clear that is so much more powerful than we are. I think some of us can go in the mountains and have a sense that this is something greater than we are, and there ought to be a healthy respect and awe for that. But other than that, I don't know where in our culture we're really finding a time or a place and are able to see that we should have, that we should be standing in that same attitude before God, who is loving, of course, we trust that, but also has this great power, power enough to bring out of nothing the entire universe. And we can't do that. So that should have a sense of awe and trembling. And we served in Ohio, my husband and I, for a long time, and we both had parishioners who were spiritual but not religious. You know, it's like our older daughter would say, no, you're just lazy, get up and go to church. But okay. That was in her younger days. I don't know. When the baby comes, we'll see how that happens. But they would say, this is in Ohio, I can worship God in the beauty of a sunset or in the glory of a mountaintop. And I would say, you're in Ohio. It's cloudy 17 months of the year, and we don't have any mountains, so whatever. But at least the instinct was there. There is some sense that here's something greater beyond us, more powerful than we are. And I don't know where we find this in our culture anymore. Do you have any ideas where people Do you? I'd rather not. I'd rather keep it to myself. So it makes it difficult, I think, for those of us who try to proclaim the word, and all of us together as baptized Christians, to try either to stay in that attitude of awe, but at the same time to try to explain to somebody else that there's something more going on in this life than what we just than this. This is important and precious, and not to be denigrated or minimized. But this isn't all there is. It's the same thing when we try to do church together and people think the local congregation is the whole deal. It's not. So I'm looking, and then you can write it down if you don't want to say it out loud. I won't make you write like Padre does. He makes us write. So I won't make you do that. But if you can think of, I don't know, metaphors or images or experiences where you truly have a sense of this majestic power, power that's so great it can create and destroy, but chooses to exercise that power in love, that would be helpful for me and I think for the church right now. So by tomorrow. So I want to read one example. How many have read The Wind in the Willows of this? I never read it, started reading it till yesterday. I only read part of it. I don't know what was wrong with my elementary school. We just never read this book. We read the My Side of the Mountain and something about this boy being blind, follow my leader, and we missed this. Anyways, so if you've not read Wind in the Willows, give it a try. It's really very dear. And they've got the mole, rat, toad, who's a problem. Then there's badger, and then otters always are getting in trouble. But then there's this thing that exists, this great being, and they're looking, mole and rat are out looking for a lost baby otter. And they're rowing, they come into this sort of numinous place. And it's just not like anything they've seen, but it's exactly what they've always seen. So this place of great mystery, but also great clarity. And they're getting closer to this being. And this is, I'll just read this a couple of paragraphs that talk about this kind of fear. Then suddenly the mole felt a great awe fall upon him, an awe that turned his muscles to water, bowed his head, and rooted his feet to the ground. It was no panic terror. Indeed, he felt wonderfully at peace and happy. But it was an awe that smote and held him, and without seeing, he knew it could only mean that some august presence was very, very near. With difficulty, he turned to look for his friend and saw him at his side, cowed, stricken, and trembling violently. And still, there was utter silence in the populous, bird-haunted branches around them. And still, the light grew and grew. Perhaps he would never have dared to raise his eyes, but that, though the piping was now hushed, the call and the summons seemed still dominant and imperious. He might not refuse, were death himself waiting to strike him instantly. Once he had looked with mortal eye on things rightly kept hidden, trembling he obeyed and raised his humble head. And then in that utter clearness of the imminent dawn, while nature, flushed with fullness of incredible color, seemed to hold her breath for the event, he looked in the very eyes of the friend and helper, saw the backward sweep of the curved horns gleaming in the growing daylight, saw the stern hooked nose between the kindly eyes that were looking down on him humorously while the bearded mouth broke into a half smile at the corners, saw the rippling muscles in the arm that lay across the broad chest, the long supple hands still holding the pan pipes only just falling away from the parted lips, saw the splendid curves of the shaggy limbs disposed in majestic ease on the sward, saw, last of all, nestling between his very hooves, sleeping soundly in entire peace and contentment, the little round, podgy, childish form of the baby otter. All this he saw for one moment, breathless and intense, vivid on the morning sky, and still as he looked, he lived, and still as he lived, he wondered. "Rat," he found breath to whisper, shaking, "are you afraid?" "Afraid?" murmured the rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. "Afraid of him? Oh, never, never. And yet, oh, mole, I am afraid." So that's pretty good way of explaining this kind of fear that is actually life-giving and expanding. And I think that's something, at least I would say in my life, is it's not as present as it could be. So coming to a place like this, perhaps, is one way for folks to find some expanse. But then how are we able, how can we, and it takes, I think, patience, which we're learning here, but also time and patience with ourselves to realize that that presence is there all the time. And I don't always see it. I'm not good at that. We were supposed to write in one sentence the opening sentence of the story of our lives at this time now. Remember that yesterday? Mine was, I have never been good about self-reflection, so I wonder about my life. What's going on? No. And when we can, maybe just even intellectually, but from time to time, actually drift into that point where we're opened up, that kind of fear makes it possible to face the actual and the manufactured fears that are so around us all the time. There is no doubt that, you know, human beings are brilliant beyond imagination and can create good and ill. The Nobel Prize was given to the guy, Nobel, who invented dynamite, which is seen as a great advance in construction. But it can also be used to blow people to bits. We can do those things. So that's real. And in our adopted city of Chicago, gun violence is a terrible thing which afflicts disproportionately people in the north and west, south and west sides of Chicago. So that's true. That's a possibility. Our kids do have now the possibility of being killed in school. So these are real things. And global climate change is a real thing. But when we understand that this is God's redeemed world already, it's possible then for us to face these actual threats and dangers without pulling back and being so turned in on ourselves. Luther's definition of sin, the soul curved in on itself. You're unable to open yourself up. But then I think this kind of fear helps us to face the fears that are not quite manufactured but are whipped up. The kids I met with before the youth gathering said they have soft lockdown drills and hard lockdown drills, and it's a constant part of their daily life at school. You know, I don't know how many times a month they go through these, but that is always reinforces that danger is around the corner. And we know from media outlets, we might be blessed, even though we're jonesing a little bit for our news media, that we're not hearing that constant infusion, that whip up actual fears into something that puts us into blaming the other person, herding together and counting loyalty above everything else, being reactive all of the time. This kind of fear gives us, of God, puts us in a place where, first of all, we're not in charge of saving the world because it's been done, but then may give us a chance to breathe for once. So I think when, back to the scripture, this is what Isaiah was trying to deliver from God to these people who had lived in a state of anxiety and fear amongst these foreigners at this point for at least three generations. And what they now were sensing and perceiving had become real for them, and the reality of an awesome God who was in charge of the entire and present in the entire universe, loved them and was going to redeem them. They couldn't hear that. And so Isaiah needed to speak this word to these people over and over again, and not just then in the 6th century BC, but we as a community, and we can mean all of us in Holden Village, it can mean all of us in our congregations, in our denominations, but all of us, perhaps I won't go over the whole world, but in our country, in our communities, we need to hear this over and over again. What's it? This is my Father's world. And there's that one line that, oh, the wrong seems off so strong, God is the ruler yet. And that's the kind of fear I think that's liberating. So now, that's what I've got on fear, and we won't talk about this anymore, but we got 12 minutes and you can ask each other questions, ask me questions, observations, correct me. I'll try to encapsulate that for folks. When we were moving towards a decision, which turned out to be the decision to include LGBTQ folks in those in committed relationships, which now includes marriage, it was a very tense time for our church. And in his congregation, they found that when they got together, even if they didn't agree, but had conversations together in Bible study, they were able to come to the point, and see if I'm getting this right, that this wasn't just something that the church had cooked up, but this was something that had proceeded by the Spirit proceeding throughout, and that a sense of call is something that comes from outside of us and proceeds through us, and that maybe if we were to take a step back and realize that the Spirit is still moving, that we could find a way, even out of political, cultural difficulties, if we understand that movement of the Spirit. Was that close? Okay, thank you. Then there was a hand over here. Oh, I'm starting to sound like Padraig and Glenn. Well done. Yay. So she had the experience of being in Israel, and when young kids, I mean, they were under than 17 all the way down to kindergartners, anytime they go out on a field trip, they always had an armed guard with them. And my husband and I had a chance to go over with a conference of bishops, and we saw the same thing. And she's wondering, with that constant reminder that the world's a dangerous place, what does that do to the children, and how does that shape their vision and experience with the world and with the Palestinians? So we had two men talk to us, the Conference of Bishops and Spouses, when we were there. One was a Palestinian Muslim, and another was an Israeli Jew. And the Israeli Jew, his daughter had been blown up in one of these, in the Intifada. And so devastating. And the Palestinian Muslim, his father had died because he had a heart attack and he couldn't get through the checkpoints. And so they both had these experiences of what the situation was doing to them. And instead of just reverting to anger and revenge, they decided that they were going to start to share their stories with Muslims and Christians and Jews and with Palestinians and with Israelis. And the interesting thing that they found is that the Israelis would say, no, you can't listen to this. This is terrible. But the Palestinians would say to their kids, be strong. Don't believe this propaganda that the Jews are, you know, the Israelis can be dealt with or human. So it's constantly reinforced. And it's just like really frightening to go to those checkpoints when you got 18-year-old teenagers with guns who might be having a bad day. Because Shlomo stood up Sarah, and it's like, okay, then it's pretty arbitrary going through those. You can get stopped or not. You know, we Westerners, particularly if we're in a bus, most of the times we sail through. We had one experience where we weren't in the official thing. It was still pretty official. And we were trying to get to an archaeological site, and they weren't going to have it. And so we got turned back. But we didn't go through the hours of waiting. But you're right. Children constantly in the presence of someone with guns reinforces that the world's a dangerous place, and those people are the ones who are perpetrating danger. Not to say that there isn't real danger. I was there another time, and they tried to explain to us that, you know, when they put the wall up, it did, the separation wall, it did stop some of the terrorist attacks. For them during the intifadas, that it would be like the Boston Marathon bombing happening like every 2 weeks. So there's this the real fear, but then when it's reinforced and generated so you can't see the other as human, it makes it really difficult. Very good, thank you. They're still doing it too. We have social screens and the investments that we have, that's part of our what the ELCA's position is, that if companies are engaged, we engage in positive investment. So we're not into divestment, boycott, divestment, or sanctions. We that's not our position. That is the position of the Presbyterian Church USA. But we, listening to our partners on the ground, which is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land, say positive investment is more effective, they feel. And then we're still part of the corporate conversation. But then we invest in Palestinian enterprises as opposed to that. I don't know if we're invested in Hewlett-Packard or not, but we have social screens to say, if, for example, we don't invest in companies that make guns or are part of the for-profit prison or detention system. I'm not sure where we are with Hewlett-Packard. I'd say I'd call my staff, but I can't, but I'll try to find out about that. But we do take a look at that. But then this is also a point of contention within the church where we do have, I think, good and reasoned conversations. Should we be more aggressive in screening out or even boycotting companies which we feel are working against peace and justice? And that was a huge conversation, if you remember, in the 80s when apartheid was being, should we divest? And, you know, I was all for divestment back then. I was a little brand new little pastor and yay. But it turns out to be, it's a complicated situation. So we need to hear from people saying, no, we're not going far enough, at the same time to say, well, this is what we're doing now. So I don't know what the policy is with Hewlett-Packard, that they're participating, I think some would say, in the oppression of the Palestinians. I'll write that down. I'd say go to our website, but I can't navigate our website. It's kind of confusing. But Hewlett-Packard in particular, okay. I know we're not in SodaStream. We don't do that. And just to let you know, that Sabra, I don't know if you get Sabra hummus out here. That's made on Israeli settlements that are illegal settlements. So we would not invest in Sabra. We would invest in a product made from the Israeli settlements. So just saying, the next time you're in the grocery store, you could choose not to invest in Sabra. You know, if you think about it, the situation in Israel and Palestine, that's maybe a really clear example of this stirring up constant fear. And there are narratives on both sides, and there are points in history when the other side would say could have compromised and they didn't, and they were in this place that almost seems intractable. Some of the actions that the Israeli government took most recently, where we've spoken out against very strongly, and that's declaring that Israel is primarily a Jewish state. So if you're Muslim or Christian, you know, de facto, maybe not de jure, but de facto, that makes you a second-class citizen. And that Hebrew is the official language, and Arabic will now be a recognized language, which automatically, I think, others even more, those people who don't speak Hebrew. And that's never been part of the formula before, at least in law, so that's happening there more. But I had a friend who once said, the Palestinians, you know, for all the stuff that stirs up about there, they have not really been supported, except by Jordan, by their surrounding Muslim states. Jordan does an amazing job. Also, Jordan is home to, I think, more Christians in the Middle East than any other place. I think maybe even more than Israel, who have a lot of guest workers. But the others, and so we've got this continuing conflict that goes on. And he said that Palestinians turn out to be the Jews of the Arabs. And if you think, is that true, that they're so discounted by others and marginalized? And then Israel gets in this. We had a chance, I had a chance to meet at their Pentagon or State Department. Their soldiers wear flip-flops with their fatigues. It's just like not expected. I mean, they wear boots when they're in on duty. But so this one colonel was saying, you know, Israel has this two things they have to fight about. Against the Palestinians, they're seen as Goliath, and the Palestinians are David. But they feel that in the surrounding territory, they're David, and the Arab world around them is Goliath. And so how do they try to negotiate that? It's an incredibly complicated situation, but I think it builds on fear of the other. Mm-hmm. So talking about humility and awe, and realizing the humility that God showed by being born in human flesh in a manger, by entering Jerusalem on a donkey, by associating with those who are on the margins. I think that's really a good point, and I think we lose that when we lose a sense of awe. If that's when I say sometimes it just seems, well, of course, it's sort of, we're entitled. And it's inevitable that God would be born as a human being and live our life and, you know, of course. And we lose that when we have the sense that this is the creator. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that the way God makes his argument to Job. But he says, where were you when this was all formed? And so if we're somehow able to come into that sense of awe that the one who created everything would then humble himself, as it says in Philippians 2, to take on human form, and that the same all-powerful God would then suffer on the cross and die the most brutal death that the Romans could think of, then we have a sense of awe and reverence.